Welcome back to the Plus Ultra Podcast. This is Tracy R. Twyman. Now comes part two of our interview with Peter Lavenda, author of Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, and the brand new three-part series, Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. Later on, we're going to get into the subject of the Necronomicon, which Lavenda had some involvement with, and has even been rumored to be the author of. But first, a little necessary background information on the man, Lavenda. He's led an exciting life that started with him founding his own Orthodox church, attending the funeral of Robert Kennedy as a clergyman, and working as an unofficial intelligence asset for the U.S. military. Here once again is Peter Lavenda.
Peter, where did you grow up, and what sort of a upbringing did you have?
I grew up all around the country. I was born in New York City, but my parents moved around a lot as I was growing up. So we lived in Indiana, in Chicago for a number of years, in New Hampshire for a couple of years, but I basically graduated from high school in New York City. We eventually made our way back there. My father was a kind of a failed actor, and between one thing and another, our family just wound up wandering around the country looking for work.
And I understand that your father at one point was involved in something that has caused you a bit of embarrassment and got you some scrutiny from the government, too.
Yeah, his name is mentioned in a few books, mostly books written by academics about a particular period in the history of Gary, Indiana, which is where he was born and raised. And he was involved in something called the Gary School Strike, which I believe was 1945 or 1946, something like that. And that was a school strike that was started over integration. There was a move to integrate the public schools in Gary, Indiana. And my father was involved in some kind of debating team at Broble High School, which is where he was going to school. And he was the president of the students' union at the same time. And the debate was over whether or not the schools should be integrated or segregated. And my father came down on the segregation part and became kind of well known as a segregationist and as the leader of the Gary School Strike. So basically he was a segregationist. And it caused so much furor in the country at the time that Frank Sinatra, who was on his way, I guess, to some gig in Chicago, decided he would stop over in Gary, Indiana and try to solve the problem to the force of his own personality, I suppose. So he made a visit to the Gary High School auditorium where there was a big meeting on the issue of integrating the schools, and he was not warmly received. He was seen basically as an outsider trying to come in and solve the problems, and not finding very much success there, he went to my father's home to try to convince him to call off the school strike. So you'll find in there's a book out, I believe, that's called The Frank Sinatra Files, which is a collection of the FBI files on Sinatra, particularly during this period, and my father's name is mentioned there a number of times. The FBI thought my father was a communist, which is the funniest thing, because they knew that Sinatra had had some kind of associations with some leftist or socialist types, and they thought that Sinatra's presence in Indiana was some kind of a socialist thing, and therefore they were making the assumption that my father was somehow a communist, which was 180 degrees opposite from what he was. I mean, as a segregationist, he was a right-wing kind of John Bircher type, mm-hmm. and there was no way in on earth that you could mistake him for a communist. But at any rate, the FBI thought he might be, so they were collecting files on him.
How did your father react to having Frank Sinatra come over to his house?
He threw him out.
What was his name?
Leonard Lavenda.
Now, I understand around the time you were going to graduate high school, you were staring the possibility of the draft in the face, yep. and trying to figure out how to get out of that, and you couldn't afford to go to college to use that as a way out. So you and a friend of yours named Andrew came up with a very unusual idea. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. Well, like many things in life, there's always more than one motivation. My friend and I were very involved in religious studies, let's say. I was very involved in studying religion. It had always been a fascination of mine since I was very young. And all forms of religion, including, you know, extreme forms like occultism or mysticism on the one hand, and different religious groups on the other, I would haunt all sorts of churches and temples, whatever I could find, just to get some kind of an idea of what was going on. And I was very religiously minded in my late teens. I was really thinking seriously of some kind of religious vocation. And I had met a friend of mine in high school in the Bronx who was had a similar background to mine. He was half Czech and half Slovak. And he also had a fascination for the church, but his fascination was more for the pomp and ceremony of it. Mm. He liked the vestments, and he liked the golden chalices and all the rest of it. And he liked the way in which, you know, clergymen were afforded all sorts of extra privileges that the rest of us didn't enjoy. And this was a different time, I have to remind you and your listeners. Back in the 1960s, clergymen had a lot of status. I mean, they wouldn't get charged going on a bus or a subway. People would just, you know, allow them on for free. You know, this is the kind of respect that they gave. A clergyman could walk into almost any building anywhere and be accorded all sorts of immediate respect. These days, of course, that's changed a lot, but in the old days, this was an old-fashioned kind of idea, and my friend really liked that. So, two of us were graduating high school in 1968, which pretty much meant we were probably going to Vietnam or something close to it. And my idea was, why not form a church? Because we knew that clergymen would not be drafted. So we formed a church. We organized a church around a man that we knew who was a bishop from Slovakia who was living as a displaced person in the United States. And he had been, had a very checkered career in the church. He was involved with a church in Czechoslovakia. There was the invasion by the Nazis and the invasion by the Russians, and eventually he got out and came to the United States, and the church was sort of formed around him. So we got together and said, you know, let's form a church, let's use this guy as our spiritual leader, and we'll incorporate the church, and we'll become clergymen in the church.
You, of course, were 17 years old at the time?
That's right.
Okay, yep. Please continue. Just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, well, we were a little precocious, it's true. But, you know, it was 1968, it was Vietnam. I mean, it was. We were motivated. So the motivation was definitely there. And so we said, you know, let's do this. And we incorporated it. Of course, we were too young, actually, to sign the incorporation papers ourselves. So we had to get other people to help us do that. And so we had adults sign off on the papers, and we incorporated the church. And we held services. I mean, we held services every Sunday. We went and visited other churches in New York City. This was an Orthodox church.
Who came to the services?
Excuse me?
Did people come to the services?
Oh, sometimes. Friends of ours, perhaps. It got to the point where we had developed a kind of a small floating congregation, you know. We were intent on doing this the right way, you know. So we were trying to run a legitimate ecclesiastical type organization. I mean, that was the whole point. So what we did is we imposed upon a Protestant minister in the Bronx who had a church, a very nice Dutch Reformed church, and we managed to cut a deal with him that we would be able to use his church for services, you know, on days when he wasn't using it. So he would have a service on Sunday, let's say at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and then we would do something at 11 o'clock or whatever. So it worked out pretty well for a while.
This involvement with the church seems to have led to you noticing, being privy to the involvement of U.S. intelligence in these obscure Orthodox churches.
Sure.
At a certain point, you were actually asked by someone in the military to spy on other people in your church?
I'm not quite sure if military is the right word. It's kind of murky and ambiguous.
Okay.
I'll give you a little bit of the background on this. After the Kennedy funeral, as we were leaving the church, we ran into a couple of people who were dressed oddly and appeared to be people sort of similar to us. And they just asked us a few questions about what church we represented, etc. And they gave us a few brochures from their own church. They wanted to introduce themselves to us and wanted us to go visit them, and their church was in the Bronx also. So we decided we would check them out. And we went to the church. It was on 183rd Street and Arthur Avenue in the Bronx at that time. It's not there anymore. And it was a beautiful little building. And it was the headquarters of something called the American Orthodox Catholic Church, AOCC.
Mm-hmm.
And we became involved with them. We visited them on one Sunday. We hung out with them for a while. They had no clue that we were younger. We were under 21. They thought, you know, with all of our ropes and all of our the knowledge that we had acquired, that we were at least in our 20s. This led to a kind of a contretemps later, but at the moment, everything was fine. We went along swimmingly in this relationship. And the head of that church, of the AOCC, was a man called Profeta, Walter Profeta, sometimes Vladimir Profeta. And he boasted of his relationships with U.S. intelligence. Now I'm only 17, 18 years old at the time.
And this is the American Orthodox Catholic Church is neither a normal Catholic Church nor a normal Orthodox Church, is it?
Yeah, you could say it's neither American nor Orthodox, but it was, well, Profeta himself was a Ukrainian. He was a priest in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is a legitimate denomination. And for reasons that are too long probably to go into here, he left the Ukrainian Church and started this American Orthodox branch. There's a lot of background history to it, and it goes on and on, but basically the short form is he started his own church and became the bishop of his own church, and eventually the patriarch of his own church. So he gave himself a lot of titles. But as a Ukrainian, he was a dedicated anti-communist. I mean, this was his raison d'etre, was fighting communism. And he had been on television a number of times trying to alert the American people to the dangers of communism. He was a specialist in promoting the news about the Katyn Forest massacre, which the Soviets had instigated, killing a lot of Ukrainian people and burying them in ditches and all that sort of thing. So he was a prominent anti-communist. And he showed me once a letter that he received from Thomas Dewey, promising him he would be the White House chaplain when Dewey won the presidency. So you remember Dewey was running against Truman,
right.
And Profeta was packing his bags that night, thinking that Dewey had won,
wow.
And he was getting ready to become the chaplain. Of course, Truman won, and he was out. So that was going on, and then every once in a while, people would show up at the church in, you know, black wingtips and white shirts and black ties, and they would go into Profeta's office and have little meetings in there. And Profeta would openly boast that on his board of directors, he had one FBI agent and one CIA agent. So he told me all of this, and I carefully paid attention to it and filed it away. Little did I know the extent of his operation until years later when I began to read the declassified Kennedy assassination files and find out that the AOCC was kind of prominent, at least in Jim Garrison's mind, when he was conducting his investigation in New Orleans. Because David Ferry belonged to it, Jack Martin belonged to it. A lot of the supposed co-conspirators in the Kennedy assassination were members of the AOCC. They were not just lay members, I mean, they were bishops, priests and bishops of the church.
Wow.
So I conducted investigations later,
mm-hmm.
As late as 5 years ago or so, meeting some of these bishops who were still alive and having correspondence with them and interviewing them, and it's a wild story. You know, it's just unbelievably strange. Profeta had managed to get Hoover to give him a kind of, I don't know what you would call it, a kind of blessing to start the church, and he was using the FBI security people to check the references of people who wanted to become bishops in his church. I mean, it was a very incestuous relationship
wow.
between the AOCC and the FBI. The AOCC was used to move agents into and out of the country, even when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
During the Biafran Civil War in Nigeria, we had a bishop, a so-called bishop, come in from Nigeria to be consecrated a bishop in New York by Profeta and sent back into Nigeria. Could never figure what that was all about. But this bishop was the anti-Biafran forces. He represented the nationalist forces, you know. So wherever there was a good side or a bad side, Profeta was always on the bad side of any conflict, you know. So I met this guy myself. I mean, I was there at the airport to welcome him into the country. And his name was Aluya, but it was Holy Prophet Aluya. That was his name. So in his ordination or consecration document, he's there as Bishop H.P. Aluya. You know, Bishop Holy Prophet Aluya. I mean, I wasn't even sure if this guy was Christian, but he was a bishop in the church. There was always an intelligence angle to everything Profeta was doing. There was always some weird agenda. There were always some strange people coming in and going out. And as I found out later, the AOCC was still involved as late as the Serbian and Kosovo crisis. I mean, there's members of the church that I knew back in the 1960s who were involved in running guns and laundering money for some of the Serbian war criminals. So, you know, they've been around for a long time, and they always seem to be involved in something intelligence related, and always on the anti-communist or the right wing or fascist side.
Someone from the government contacted you, trying to get you to spy for them?
Well, it wasn't like that. What happened was, one of the whole reasons for this church and everything else, of course, was to give us a kind of a shield where the draft was concerned. And as long as we were conducting services, as long as we were behaving as clergymen and doing what we could, it was a legitimate shield. But we still had to have the imprimatur of the selected service people in order to, you know, to make sure we weren't drafted. And what we had to do was go to the head of selective service in New York City. And I had a meeting with him, with another clergyman of this American Orthodox Catholic Church, of the AOCC. We had a meeting with the head of the selective service operation, of that selective service system, in New York City. A colonel. He had the rank of colonel in the army, I suppose, but he wore civilian clothes. And very sort of John, or let's say Alan Dulles appearance, you know, patches on the elbows, a tweed jacket, a mustache, and pipe. And he sat there and he gave me the 4D status, which is the ministerial deferment, right there.
Mm-hmm.
But normally you don't get that from the head of selective service, right? It's something that's processed through paperwork.
Right.
But this was done face-to-face, and there was an understanding, you know, that we're all in this thing together, and that the Orthodox churches are somewhat suspect. You know, some of the Russian churches were running spies into the U.S. from Moscow.
Oh.
We knew this. This was even covered in the newspapers at the time.
Okay.
So there was this understanding there was going to be a quid pro quo. So
For you to spy on other clergy for the government,
right,
in exchange for your draft
for my
deferment.
Status, for my deferment, right.
Okay. And so, did you actually do this for a while? Did you report?
Well, there was nothing to report.
Okay.
You know, it was all sort of stupid. I mean, we would go to the Russian Orthodox Church because we were trying to form relationships with other Orthodox churches. And was defecting from the whole thing. All the intelligence stuff that was going on, all the politics, all of the backstabbing sort of pissing me off. And Andrew was in a mode of self-glorification to the point where I was getting, the oxygen was very thin around him. So he eventually formed an alliance with another Ukrainian Orthodox Church and formed, a kind of a sustainable lifestyle based on that. And he had a lot of other priests and monks from different denominations, different Orthodox churches who joined his church, especially once he had the kind of legitimacy of his involvement with some legitimate Orthodox churches. So he attracted some other people, but some of the people he attracted were less than savory characters. And two of them were monks who were involved in rare book theft. These were guys who made their living going from library to library, whether it was university libraries, public libraries, personal collections, and stealing books. And they would steal these books. They had these big voluminous robes that we mentioned at the beginning of the program. And they would hide books. They would take them out to a van that they had that had equipment in there for erasing the ink markings of libraries, for raising the seals, like the impressions of the, I don't know what to call them, like the paper seals from the libraries. So they could eradicate all this stuff and then sell the books, you know, to collectors. They were making a living doing this, and they were based in New York City. They had an operation in Queens, in Jamaica, Queens, and they had equipment up there for processing these stolen books. And they would occasionally rebind them, or they would tear out the illustrations and the maps and sell them separately, which was, you know, horrible crime.
Yes.
It was absolutely horrible and unbelievable. So they would do that. And they belonged to the Slavonic Orthodox Church. And Andrew knew about this. He knew what they were up to, and as long as they were kicking back stuff to him, he didn't really mind it very much, you know, as long as they didn't involve him in the actual theft. So Andrew's interest was always in books of an occult nature. So he had a small collection, a growing collection of old tomes, you know, of various kinds. And as it turned out, he had stacks of things in boxes, manuscripts, and all that sort of thing. I was over there one day, and the rest is history. I opened up the box and saw a manuscript with a Greek name, and we didn't know what it meant. You know, Necronomicon. We thought, you know, it means something to do with the dead. You have to understand that we didn't read H.P. Lovecraft. We weren't reading that stuff. We had no knowledge of it back in the 70s. It wasn't part of our lifestyle, you know, to read occult fiction.
So you'd never heard
of Gothic horror or stuff. It just wasn't there. You know, we didn't know. So for us, the name meant nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just that it meant something to do with death, you know, with death. And there were some strange sigils and stuff in it, and it looked pretty cool, you know. And that was really the discovery of it. I mean, it was just right there. We said, let's do something with this.
So you borrowed it for a while. Photocopied it, and then gave it back.
Right.
And it ended up disappearing, right?
The original, yes. This was due to the fact that these book thieves then were shortly thereafter arrested by the feds. And their arrest made national headlines. It made headlines in the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, everywhere, front page, you know, global fold, but front page. It was the largest rare book heist in the history of the United States. These guys had pulled off something unbelievable. And there's lists, very partial lists, in the newspaper accounts of the universities they had gone to and the books that they had stolen. And it's, like I say, very partial. They had stolen books all over the country, including Canada and Mexico. So I think they had to make restitution somehow, give back the books they did have. They still had in their possession, and give an accounting of other books. But, I mean, the task was daunting. There were just so many books that had been stolen that I don't know if they ever, you know, gave a full accounting. But the documentation that exists is only that they stole books from all the major libraries, from all the major universities, some of which were worth, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So
when they were arrested, Andrew went nuts. He was very frightened that he was going to be implicated in all of this, so he destroyed whatever he had that the monks had given him to make sure that he would not be implicated.
So, do you think it's possible that that's when the original of the Necronomicon was destroyed?
Well, the one that I saw, I'm sure, was destroyed. He destroyed everything. I mean, he had some very good books there. It was a shame. He had some old books on astrology, on palmistry, different languages, you know, French and Latin. I mean, there was a lot of interesting stuff that he had, which disappeared. I mean, after he died, you know, no one's seen it. No one's seen any of it. He destroyed a lot of stuff. I mean, there was a lot of political stuff around Andrew lately, towards the end of his life as well. So, you know, he kept those. He had some ornate furnaces, stoves. You know, these porcelain stoves, like from the Renaissance period, you know, some beautiful pieces of, he was an antique collector, he loved antiques, and he, you know, these were coal-fired, and he just kept those things running day and night, what I understand is he was burning, you know, a lot of stuff that he had, scared to death, he would wind up in jail along with the monks who belonged to his church.
And how did he end up dying? Is he dead?
Well, it's a little spooky. People say it was suicide. And probably that's what it was. One of his hobbies was in gilding metal. So he would, you know, put gold leaf on something, or he would play with metals a lot and with gilt. And you use arsenic in that process of electroplating. And the story is that somehow a vial of arsenic fell and he died from the fumes. But the story doesn't hold water because he had a cat in the laboratory with him. His little place in the Bronx, and the cat survived. He didn't die from any fumes. It appears as though it was either murder or suicide.
Wow.
It might have been suicide. His father had committed suicide a few years before.
Right.
So it's possible that the guilt of it had just weighed upon him. But there were political situations as well. The Ukrainian church that he was involved with suddenly came into its own with the fall of the Soviet Union. And the life that he had been living up until then was being threatened. The heads of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church from the Ukraine were coming to the United States to kind of reassert their authority over the parishes and the dioceses here, and I think that Andrew knew he was on his way out one way or the other. So, who knows? You know, it could have been a combination of things, I just don't know.
Well, it's so interesting, you know, there are so many of these things in history, and you discuss a lot of them in your books, where something really significant happened, and then the proof of it disappears. And you know, it's happened to me, too, so I know it happens. But it seems to happen really, you know, with these significant documents. I mean, I guess you have a little bit of sympathy for Joseph Smith in a way, you know, his original gold plates disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, it happens, it happens all the time.
So the story is just, at this point, you were hanging out at the Magical Child Shop, you knew Simon, and you also knew, you still knew Andrew, and you knew that you became aware that he had this book, and so you copied it for yourself and gave it back, and then you and Simon, and I guess some other people, translated it and prepared it for publication.
That's right.
Okay. And then it basically spent a little while in low circulation with the limited edition copies being printed, and then Avon Books printed a paperback version, and it became this huge hit.
We didn't expect it. We had done a lot of thinking about this book. I mean, it was Herman Slater who said, you know, you've got to be kidding me, you don't have the real Necronomicon, do you? And we said, well, you know, what is that? You know, and he said, you have to be kidding, you don't know Lovecraft, you don't know any of this stuff, and we said, no. You know? And it was Herman Slater who was instrumental in saying, no, this book has got to find a publisher. And he tried to find a publisher on his own a number of times, and he just couldn't find one, like nobody was interested. And then Larry Barnes showed up one day, deliberately looking for the Necronomicon, you know, because he was a Lovecraft fanatic, and he saw an occult story, so he figured, I'll go in and ask, you know. He went in and asked, and Herman Slater had the manuscript there. I mean, the translated, you know, thing. And he said, "Well, here, you know, yeah, we do have it." You know, so at that point, Barnes, who was a printer, was involved in the printing trade. His father was a printer. Decided that he would want to print the book himself, and so we did a limited edition in leather. You know, so there that came out. I think it was the three editions all together, or limited editions. It sort of fell out of it after a while, but they went through a number of editions, and then the thing got sold to Avon as a paperback, and it became a phenomenon. You know, Hal K. Barnes was pretty good, though. The Barnes' sense for advertising and marketing was pretty good. He loved to design advertising, and he would put full-page ads in magazines as disparate as National Lampoon and Psychology Today. Full-page ads for the Necronomicon, and what a bizarre approach, but it worked. You know, it got a lot of coverage from a lot of places. And naturally, the book was attacked immediately, as soon as it came out. You know, this is not the Necronomicon. This is a horrible pastiche. It's a horrible hoax. It's so poor. It's so pathetic. It isn't really even Lovecraft, you know. And all of that went on. As far as I was concerned, the fact that it wasn't really Lovecraft meant that it probably was, you know, the real Necronomicon.
Right, yeah.
You know, if it was a hoax, it would have been a lot better than what it was.
Because when Lovecraft was around, nobody really knew much about Sumeria, did they?
I mean, Sumeria was discovered. I mean, they knew about it, I think, in World War I period. I mean, before he died, information had come out about Sumeria, but it wasn't a lot. The tablets hadn't been translated until years after, I think, after he died. So the major Sumerian works hadn't come out yet, you know, in print. You know, the Enuma Elish and all of the other creation epics and stuff. I don't think that came out while he was alive. I'm not sure now that you asked, but I don't think the stuff was out yet. So it's unusual that, you know, his references to it matched, you know, with some of the Sumerian stuff that came out later.
Uh-huh. But he wouldn't have been able to imagine that the Necronomicon was, you know, a partially Sumerian text or based on a Sumerian text.
I doubt that very much. You know, I don't think he could have gone there.
All right, we're back at the Plus Ultra podcast. This is Tracy R. Twyman, and now here's more from Peter LaVenda.
So back to your story. Okay, so there was a major meaningful coincidence that happened there where Herman Slater has this Necronomicon, what he believes to be the Necronomicon, but he can't find a publisher for it. And so all of a sudden, this guy who happens to be really into the occult and into Lovecraft, he just almost on a whim walks into the store and asks if you ever heard of the Necronomicon, or if you have the Necronomicon, not really expecting you to say yes, and then Herman Slater says, yeah, I have it right here, and then it turns out that this guy He's a publisher.
Right. Imagine the rush, right?
Oh, yeah.
When you go into a store and say, you know, offhandedly, do you have an economic on it? Someone says, yes. So it was quite a rush for him. I mean, it changed his life. It was a major influence, you know, on him. I mean, he was focused on it 100% after that. Broken only briefly by the death of Elvis Presley, whom he idolized as well, and he made an Elvis Presley calendar or something. But in the midst of the Necronomicon, he was really totally focused on it, on creating, you know, the most beautiful possible edition he could. And quite frankly, I think that that first leather edition was a little tacky. It was just too much silver and, you know, too many gargoyle-ish looking emblems, too much eldritch stuff on there. But anyway, he liked it, and it was very successful. You know, the first edition sold out before it was even printed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sold out strictly word of mouth. So it paid for itself.
So,
and then the other two editions after that, and finally Avon picked it up. And I think with Avon, it sold, I don't know, close to a million copies since it came out in 1980, I think.
A million?
So, you know, that's not really a bestseller in terms of the New York Times, but it's, you know, it's steady.
Simon and also William S. Burroughs, who wrote a letter after he read the Necronomicon, wrote a letter to you guys. They both seem to think that the publication of the Necronomicon was a historically significant event, that this is going to have a major ripple effect, or that it has already had a major ripple effect on public consciousness, pop culture, history. I mean, do you agree with that? Do you think that it was an important event?
Well, yeah, I think it was important in several different ways. In the first place, where the New Age is concerned, a lot of the occultism is Judeo-Christian, let's say. The Keys of Solomon, you know, the books of the 6th, 7th, and 8th books of Moses and all this kind of stuff. And it was all based upon a Jewish and Christian concept. But with the coming of the New Age, you had a lot of neo-paganism. And there was not a system of ceremonial magic designed for a neo-pagan mentality. It was all based upon, you know, Jewish and Christian concepts, which were themselves borrowed from pagan, you know, origins.
Mm-hmm.
But the pagan origins were gone. I mean, for the most part, there were no texts about that. So I think, in a sense, the Necronomicon kind of filled a need for people with neo-pagan sensibilities to become involved in the higher magic, shall we say. That's one thing. That's very specific, I suppose.